Thank you very much. Okay, so this is the title of my talk of today. So the idea is to tell you a story about how I've moved from dealing with the dry granular flows and moving to sediment transport, so to incorporate the role of the interstitial fluid in the model. So a brief introduction for those of who are not familiar with kinetic theory. So this is a kind of what is a gas actually. So you can think of a gas as a molecules just traveling around randomly, apparently. And the same kind of picture applied to a granular gases with some difference that I will explain to you later. So the idea is that the motion of these particles is chaotic, so random, and they interact with each other through instantaneous and binary collisions. Okay, so for a gas, the collisions are elastic, so you don't lose energy in a collision. For a granular gas, on the other hand, collisions are inelastic, so you lose some energy in a collision. Okay. So from here, the simplest theory that you can build, which is a simple kinetic theory, is based on the theory of transport phenomena. So given that there are particles moving around, the particles are carrying mass, momentum with themselves. So you can think that they are crossing a surface. So you can think of a very simple situation in which the mean velocity field is zero. So you have a surface, and you can think that the particles are crossing the surface, and they are bringing momentum with them. So you can calculate very easily which is the average flux of x momentum across this surface in a certain time interval. And there are some issues about which kind of average you have to perform. So the idea behind is a statistical average, okay? And from this definition, you can easily define the stresses, in particular, in this case, the normal stresses. So the normal stresses are just proportional to this average of the square of the random velocity field. Times the particle density times a variable, which is the solid volume fraction or the concentration. Okay. This is for the normal stresses. Of course, you can take the isotropic component of the normal stresses, and this is the pressure. And you can see that the pressure is proportional to this guy. And this guy, or better, one-third of this guy, is what it is called the granular temperature. It is the analog of the thermodynamic temperature, and it tells you how agitated is the granular gas. Okay, so the pressure is proportional to the granular temperature. So this is the main idea of these two slides. You can do the same for the shear stress and find similar expression involving once again the granular temperature. So of course things are more complicated than that, because what I told you applied to a very dilute gas, because if the gas is not so dilute, there are some complications, because you can transfer momentum not only because a particle is moving around, but also because particle is colliding with another particle, okay? And there are other effects. So, but apart this complication, the other idea is that you have collisions in a granular gas, and as I told you before, in a classic gas, the collisions are perfectly elastic, so you don't lose energy. In a granular gas, on the other hand, the collisions are inelastic. And one way to define the inelasticity is through this coefficient, E. And this coefficient tells you that the ratio of post to pre-collisional relative velocity between two colliding particles is less than 1. Okay? So if it's less than 1, that means that you are losing some energy during the impact, because of the impact. So this characterizes the collisions. Okay, so this is a very crude picture of what happens in a colliding granular gas. So as I told you, you can come out with an expression for the pressure. Once again, proportional to granular temperature. Instead of having simply the solid volume fraction in the most complicated cases, you have a function of the volume fraction and of the coefficient of restitution. So I'm not entering into the details on how these functions have been derived, okay? But we have explicit expression for this function, okay? So they are maybe not so nice, maybe a little, maybe strongly nonlinear, but they are explicit function of the solid volume fraction and the coefficient of restitution. So this is for the pressure. Something similar for the shear stress. The shear stress is proportional to this guy, which is the shear rate, okay? I'm just focusing on planar flows, so because it's simpler, okay? And this guy is something like the viscosity, if you want. And the viscosity is proportional to the square root of the granular temperature in the context of kinetic theory. And these two guys are the constitutive relations for the pressure and the shear stress. So because there is this variable involved, the granular temperature, you need an additional equation for the evolution of this variable. And this additional equation is the balance of the fluctuating energy for the particles. And this balance tells you that the rate of change of the fluctuating energy is due to diffusion, production, and dissipation, usual form of the transport equation. But kinetic theory provides constitutive relation for the energy flux, okay, proportional to the gradient of the temperature and proportional to the gradient of the solid volume fraction, and provides explicit expression for the dissipation, okay? In a classic gas, ideal gas, if you like, the coefficient of restitution is 1. So this guy is 0. So you don't have dissipation. And this balance, in this balance, the dissipation term is just 0, okay? In a granular gas, instead, you have this term. And this is peculiar to the granular gas, okay? In the dissipation rate, which is proportional to this power 1/2 of the granular temperature, at the denominator there is a length scale, and which I call capital L. I will tell you something later about this length scale. Okay? Yes?
Is F3 only a function of mu?
Sorry?
Is F3 only a function of mu, not of the...
Yeah, because the function of the I've separated the dependence on the coefficient of restitution, which is just 1 minus e squared. Yeah. So this one thing, this function, F1, F2, F4, 5, F3, those are explicit functions. We know the expressions. For instance, in Gas and Dufty, Physical Review 1999, you can find the explicit expression for this coefficient. So as I told you, they are not so nice. So it's very long. They are very long expressions, very nonlinear. But apart from that, we know these guys. Okay. So we know everything in this slide.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Is there a special motivation behind the kind how you define the restitution coefficient?
Well, it's the simplest possible way in which you can define the collisions. I mean, you are disregarding all the dynamics involved during the time that two particles spent in contact, and you just focus on which is the relative velocity before and after the collisions. Okay, and you assume that this coefficient is a constant. And completely characterize your collision.
But there was no tangential components state.
Oh, sorry. So this is the simplest kinetic theory. So it holds for smooth spheres. Okay. So there is no friction involved, and the coefficient of restitution is a normal coefficient of restitution. Okay. Okay, so seems So far seems quite clear. Then, as I told you before, there is this Lamb scale and the dissipation rate. So, in the classic kinetic theory, the Lamb scale is taken to be one diameter. And the idea behind is that the particle velocities are chaotic. That means that the particle velocities are uncorrelated. So this velocity distribution of one particle has nothing to do with the velocity distribution of another particle. And this is called the molecular chaos assumption. And in this case, the Lamb scale and the dissipation rate is equal to one diameter, because just one particle is correlated just with itself. And this holds for volume fraction less than 49%. Let's say that. Okay. If the volume fraction is greater than 49%, something different happens. So you can see that the particle velocities are not anymore uncorrelated. Okay. Or on the other hand, you can see that there are clusters of particles in persistent contact or in chattering. So you have these clusters in the flow, and that means that you dissipate less because you have less collision because of the particle velocity correlation. Okay, so that means that the Lamb scale has to be greater than one diameter. And well, there's a theory developed by Jim Jenkins in 2006-07, which gives an expression for this correlation length coming from an heuristic balance between two mechanisms increasing or decreasing the size of these clusters. And it turns out that this correlation length is proportional to the ratio of the shear rate to the square root of the granular temperature. And once again, there is another coefficient which has to be fit through experiments. Okay, and this coefficient is a function of the solid volume fraction and the coefficient of restitution. Okay. How? Okay. So the 49% is a nice value because it's the lowest value of the solid volume fraction for which you can have a first phase transition from a disorder to an order state. Okay, and well, if you analyze the data on simple shear flows of numerical simulations of simple shear flows, you can infer the values of the correlation lengths, and you can see that the correlation length is equal to 1 for concentration less than 49% and greater to 1 for concentration greater than 49%. Okay. So this, once again, this is a function of solid volume fraction and coefficient restitution. Okay. Okay. Now we can even incorporate the role of friction in collisions. So the most rigorous way would be probably to add the angular momentum balance, to solve for the angular momentum balance, and to solve for the rotational fluctuating energy of the particles, okay? But this is very complicated. So a simpler way is to incorporate the role of friction, so through the tangential coefficient of restitution and through the sliding friction coefficient in an effective coefficient of restitution. So there is a theory developed once again by Jim Jenkins, 2002, okay, and it was shown that for a coefficient of sliding friction not very high, okay, you can incorporate the additional dissipation due to the rotational, okay, degree of freedom, into an effective coefficient restitution. So we can keep things very simple. So we can only use momentum balance and the energy the fluctuating energy balance that I've shown to you before. Okay, just modifying the coefficient of restitution. So the coefficient of restitution now is an effective coefficient of restitution, which takes into account the role of friction and in collisions. Okay, so this is a very simple way to do things.
Could you just explain the sticking sliding collision mechanism there?
Depending on the angle, the impending angle between two particles, yeah. two colliding particles, well, if the angle is very low, then the particles is sliding over the other particles. If the angle is a little bit steep, then you have you don't have slide. The particles collide, and then they just deform a little bit, and they roll over each other, okay? And this is a sticking collision. So in a sliding collision, is the coefficient of sliding friction which counts. In a sticking collision, is the coefficient of tangential coefficient restitution which matters.
And both of them cause rotational motion, or only one of them?
Actually, you can have a rotational only if you have interparticle friction. Okay. So that was the picture. Okay. So the idea now is to try to use that picture to solve some cases. Okay. So one case is, for instance, the steady and fully developed flow of dry particles over an erodible bed, okay? In which, of course, the driving motion of the particles is the component of the weight in the direction parallel to the flow. So you can achieve this kind of flow configuration in experiments using, for instance, a rotating drum. So there is, here, a particular cross-section of the flow, where you can think of the flow as being fully developed because there is no gradient in the direction parallel to the flow here, okay? So if you make measurements of the velocity there, that's very similar to have a measurement of a steady and fully developed flow. And it's a very cheap apparatus to have a steady flow, steady and fully developed flow with a dry particles, okay? Or you can have the same kind of flows over heap, okay? Anyway, this is the kind of flow we were interested in 2011.
To really have a steady state, what kind of length scale do you need in the rotating drum?
Well, actually, here, no matter what is the scale, but the gradient, the derivative of all the quantities in the direction parallel to the flow is equal to zero. Because there is a curvature, okay? But here the curvature has a minimum in the curvature. Yeah. So locally, the derivative along the direction of the flow is equal to zero.
That's not true if it's moving faster.
Okay. Yes, of course. Not if you have a centrifugal regime. Okay. In a rotating drum, if the angular velocity is very low, you have this stick slip behavior, so avalanching behavior. So if the angular velocity is greater, then you have this kind of a continuous flow, like this. If you increase too much, then you start to have a centrifugal flow, so everything is just a mess.
But just on your length scale of your biggest particles or your particle size,
it depends on the Froude number, right? Yeah, the Froude number calculating through the angular velocity and the size of the...
But really, what you should have is spatially uniform. So the sort of, I don't know, along a coordinate that's aligned with the flow, it should be uniform rather, you know, there's something, just having the derivative zero at a point enough, you need it. You know, it's, yeah. So there should be some more. So
yeah, the diameter cannot be very small in comparison with the diameter of the base. Yes.
But there's nothing like, is there any like number that you need for rotating drums that you could say like?
So this experiment was
steady state if we have the rotating drum of size.
Well, it's steady state, but there's still gradients in x. Or
homogeneous.
Yeah, it's not homogeneous. It's there's still something going on. There's still development along the flow direction. So. Yeah, I don't know. It's sort of a reasonable a reasonable approximation of something, but there's still gradients going on.
Well, you can make another magnitude analysis on the on this term.
Yeah, maybe small compared
to the rest, right? Yeah. Anyway, and this is a close picture of the of that kind of flow. So. So here somewhere you will have a bed, an erodible bed. And here the concentration going from the free surface towards the bed is increasing. Okay? This is what you got from measurement. So this is the picture that we had in mind of that kind of flow. So the picture of the stratification of the flow. So if from the measurement you see that the concentration is increasing going towards the bed. And the granular temperature is decreasing going towards the bed. Okay? So the idea is, at the very top of the flow, you will have a ballistic layer. Ballistic means that the concentration is so small that the particle can move in this layer without colliding with any other particles. Okay? So this is a layer where kinetic theory do not apply because you don't have collisions. Okay? The kinetic theory that I was showing to you before. Okay, then the concentration increases. So at a certain point, you will have a region where the kinetic theory should apply. So this region, we have divided this region, subdivided this region into two regions. And I will explain to you later what I mean by diffuse collisional and dense algebraic layer. Okay, and at a certain point, there is this transition towards an erodible bed where, well, you can feel that the flow is absent. So it's not strictly true because you still have a creep flow here. But the flow is so small that from the experimental point of view, the particles are simply not moving. Okay. So this is the kind of picture that we had in mind. And so for that kind of flow, we can solve equations, in particular momentum balance equations like this. And energy balance equation like this. So momentum balance along the direction perpendicular to the flow tells you simply that the gradient of the pressures must balance the component of the weight in that direction. Okay. Here everything is dimensionless using the particle density and diameter and the gravitational acceleration. Okay. So this is for the pressure. This is for the shear stress. So the momentum balance in the direction parallel to the flow. So here you have, once again, the component of the weight in the direction parallel to the flow. And then you have an additional term because the flow is between sidewalls. And the sidewalls exert a frictional force over the flow. Okay, so there are two sidewalls, and this is the reason for the two. And so this is a simple Coulomb force exerted by the sidewalls on the flow. Okay. The capital W is the distance between the sidewalls. And mu W is the coefficient of sliding friction between the particles and the sidewalls. And then you have the energy balance that I was showing to you before. Simply, the rate of change of the fluctuated energy is equal to zero in a steady and fully developed flow. So this is why I put the zero here. So diffusion. This production and dissipation only. Okay? So to those equations, you have to add the constitutive relations of kinetic theory. And you need some assumptions. And this, because we wanted to have an analytical solution to the flow. Okay? So we added some key assumptions. So the first assumption is that in the collisionless layer, the ballistic layer that I was telling to you about, the concentration is so small that the additional contribution in terms of flow rate is negligible. Okay, so you can disregard that layer. And then the idea is that in the diffuse layer here, the concentration goes from zero here to a certain value. And this certain value is the value that characterizes the dense algebraic and the bed layer. So I told you before that you have a dense granular gas if the concentration is greater than 49%. So probably here the concentration is between 49% and 60% or something like that. So in the momentum balance, it's not a great error if you take the concentration here to be constant, roughly constant, equal, I don't know, 0.6. It doesn't change so much if you take 0.55, 0.5, it doesn't change, okay? So the idea is zero here, the concentration, here 0.6, and then roughly constant, at least in the momentum balance.
I thought that some of the coefficients of in the stress tensor vary very strongly, just around events limited.
So this distribution is only for the momentum balance, not for the constitutive relations. So in the constitutive relation of kinetic theory, we keep the dependence on the volume fraction. We simplify the concentration distribution, the volume fraction distribution, only for the momentum balances. Okay. And then we think that we assume that the velocity in the diffuse layer is approximately linear, and I will explain that later why. And finally, we neglect the diffusion of energy in the dense layer. So here we have, as I told you, diffusion, production, and dissipation. This term, which is the diffusion, is important in a layer very close to the boundaries. So it can be important in an area of a depth, let's say, 5 to 10 diameters, close to the free surface or close to a rigid boundary. Okay. So the idea is that in this layer, the energy diffusion is important, but as long as you are, say, 10 diameters far from the free surface, from here, the energy diffusion is no longer important, is negligible. So you will find a dense algebraic layer here. Algebraic means that there is an algebraic balance between dissipation and production of energy. There is no diffusion there because it's negligible. And last assumption, in order to find the position of the bed, we assume that there is a yielding at the bed, so that the ratio of the shear stress to the pressure there has a characteristic value alpha that we know it's a property of the particles. Okay. So with these assumptions, these assumptions are explained in this picture here. So as I told you, free surface. So we neglect the collisionless layer. Shear stress, pressure, volume fraction equal to zero at the top of the diffuse layer. In the diffuse layer, we use classic kinetic theory with the correlation length equal to one diameter. And here, the energy diffusion can be important. At a certain point, you move from the classic kinetic theory to the extended kinetic theory. So the concentration overcomes 49%. So the correlation length is greater than one, but there the energy balance reduces to a balance between dissipation and production. Okay, so this equation is no longer a differential equation; it's an algebraic equation. And and the concentration, as I told you, is zero here, 0.6 here, 0.6 over here. And finally, at the bed, you have the yielding condition for the stress ratio. And the velocity is equal to zero there. Okay. So this is the procedure that we use to solve the problem, to have an analytical solution. In the dense algebraic layer, there is an algebraic balance between dissipation and production. That means that the ratio of the shear rate to the square root of the granular temperature is only a function of the concentration and the coefficient of restitution, okay? If you use the constitutive relations for the dissipation rate and the shear stress in the energy balance, this is what you got. And this means that the granular temperature is not longer a primitive variable of the problem because it is enslaved to the shear rate. So if you fix the shear rate and you know the concentration, you know the granular temperature there. So with this, well, the stress ratio which has this form using the constitutive relations of kinetic theory Well, it's a function of the volume fraction and the coefficient of restitution as well. Only a function of that, okay? And also the correlation length is just a function of the solid volume fraction and the coefficient of restitution. So if you use these and these, that means that the stress ratio is only a function of the correlation length and the coefficient of restitution. So at the top of the dense algebraic layer, where the correlation length is equal to one diameter, you can find the value of the stress ratio there. Okay? And the value of the stress ratio there is only a function of the coefficient of restitution.
K, sorry, but K is mu, or is...
K is mu when L equal 1. But we can say more, actually, because we can also calculate the inertial number introduced by the GDR-MIDI paper in 2004. Okay, and the inertial number in dimensionless term is just the shear rate divided by the square root of the pressure. But if you use the constitutive relation of kinetic theory and the consequence of the energy balance, well, you see that the inertial number is just a function of the concentration and the coefficient of restitution in this case. So the stress ratio and the inertial number are just a function of mu and E, but that means also that the stress ratio and the concentration are just function of I and E, okay? Or equivalently, this formulation. But this formulation is exactly what you got from the GDR-MIDI 2004 rheology. So that means that in the context of kinetic theory, the rheology of the mu I rheology holds only if the energy diffusion is negligible. Okay? Only in that case. If the energy diffusion is not negligible because you have the influence of the boundaries, for instance, you cannot use this simple rheology to solve for your flows. Okay, so the important thing is this one now. So the inertial number is just a function of the stress ratio in the dense algebraic layer. Okay, so now we have all this information. So the shear rate is the function of this and the square root of the pressure. So we know how the stress ratio varies into the flow because of the momentum balances. You take the ratio of the momentum balances and you got this equation. Then you know how the pressure is distributed because you have this very simple distribution of the concentration of the volume fraction in the flow. Then you have, we have determined the value of the stress ratio at the top of the dense algebraic layer, and we know the value of the stress ratio at the bed. So with these informations, it's very easy to integrate, for instance, this to have the velocity profile. And it's very easy also to use this information in this equation to have the depths of the flow, the depths of the various layers. So we have a complete analytical description of the flow in terms of depths, velocity, and if you do the integration, flow rate. Okay? Yes?
I didn't quite get why you know the stress ratio of the bed.
It's an assumption. So we locate the bed where the stress ratio is equal to a characteristic value that we think to know. It's a property of the particle. I mean,
something like
the angle of repose. Not exactly.
A yield condition.
A yield condition, yeah. So something like the angle of repose, not exactly because, well, I don't know.
The problem with that assumption is you also get a finite sort of flowing layer, even if you don't have N balls, if you have like a periodic simulation or something.
If I have a periodic simulation, well, what?
If you look at this drug flow, if you have very far from the end walls, you still get a finite thickness in the middle. And in that case, your yield condition would have to be the same as the friction all the way up. So there must be something else there that's setting the flow and layer thickness.
Probably, yes.
So there's some sort of result. Did you do that, Jim, or was it Nicola Tavolet, where they did DEM simulations on, or tried to do it on an erodible? It produced an erodible bed, but it wasn't clear how you got the bed in, and so the DEM simulations weren't apparent.
He did it with twin sidewalls. If you have sidewalls, then it stabilizes.
Right. Yeah. Mm. So you have sidewalls in this case.
It's very hard to say.
Yeah, but is that right? There's no point where you can actually freeze them unless you've got the sidewall friction. Yeah.
I think it's an open question.
I would like to understand with if the logic behind what you said. Are you saying that the results of GD or MIDI are not applicable close to the boundaries? And or are you saying if it turns out that these relations are still applicable, then something is amiss with your theory?
I'm saying that if you believe in kinetic theory, the mu I rheology holds only if you are far from the boundaries.
But I mean, you make a number of assumptions. So I'm trying to understand if.
Yeah, but not really. That one is not really an assumption. So the fluctuating energy balance is quite rigorous because it derives from. How do I say? It's a balance for the fluctuating energy of the particles. So the diffusion, the dissipation, and the production has that form. Okay, and so it is possible to show that if the energy flux has the form suggested by kinetic theory, then there is a length scale for the energy diffusion, which is of the order of 5 to 10 diameters. So the energy diffusion is important in a region 5 to 10 diameters. Close to the boundaries. And the boundary is either a free surface or a rigid boundary. Okay. So in the context of kinetic theory, the GDR, the mu I rheology cannot be applied close to the free surface or close to a rigid boundary. Of course, if the flow is thick enough, so if you have a flow of, 30, 40, 50 diameters, then maybe a region of 5 to 10 diameters close to the boundary is not so important, but that's another thing. Is it fair to say that? Yeah. Okay. So now we can compare this analytical solution. Okay, it's complete. Oh, there is something that I forgot to tell you. The reason for this assumption is that I'm not solving the kinetic theory equations here. I mean, when I do perform the integration, I do not perform rigorously the integration here, but we use a trapezium rule here. Okay. So what it matters is the values of the various quantities at the ends. That means at the free surface here and at the top of the dense algebraic layer here. But the trapezium rule of integration is a good idea if the quantities are linearly distributed. Otherwise, it's not so good. Okay. And we do that in order to have analytical solutions. So that's the idea.
When you say it's not so good, what goes wrong?
Sorry?
When you say it's not so good.
It cannot be so good if the quantities are not linearly distributed, because you introduce an error in the integration.
Right. But do you find solution? I mean, if you wanted to go into that layer.
It's not possible to have an analytical solution. So we have to perform a numerical integration. And we didn't want to do that. It's possible, of course, to have a solution using a numerical integration, but it was not the purpose of that work. Okay?
Igor, sorry. From the first four equations, I guess depends on the correlation length, correct?
Which one? Sorry.
Your equations. Where is the correlation length in that equation?
It's hidden in here. Because let me see.
Oop. Maybe I'm okay.
Okay. Here you have the correlation left. Is a function of 6.
Okay.
So in this guy, you have the influence of the correlation left. So you have the influence of
the
correlation
here. We change everything. The temperature also will change.
Well, the temperature in the dense layer is enslaved to the shear weight. So if you fix the shear weight, then.
I'm just wondering, if you had just the correlation length of one diameter, what would be the difference from the qualitative point of view in the solution?
Well, the difference is that this coefficient is equal to, well, you don't have this coefficient. Okay, but L equal to 1 is possible only for concentration less than 49%, so it's close to the free surface, and there you cannot neglect the energy diffusion. Okay, so here's a comparison between the results of on a heat flow by Job and co-workers, 2005, and in a rotating drum by Felix and co-workers in 2007, in terms of depth of the flow, non-dimensionalized with the distance between the sidewalls, and the particle flow rate per unit width, non-dimensionalized using, once again, the distance between the sidewalls to a certain power, to 2.5, okay? So, as you can see, so these are the results of Job, okay? And they were for very small angle of inclination, okay? And in this case, you don't have a diffuse layer at the top. So you only have a dense layer. At a certain point, if you increase somehow the flow rate, okay, then you have the influence of the diffuse layer. And this is why you have a kind of, you know, change in the slope of the curve. This is where the upper diffuse layer becomes important. And as you can see, we can follow the results in a reasonable way without tuning anything. I mean, because these were with the glass spheres, so we use an effective coefficient restitution of 0.6, which is reasonable for glass spheres. Okay, effective coefficient restitution, taking into account also the role of friction.
Is alpha then a fit parameter, or?
Okay, so alpha could be a fit parameter, but I use the for alpha, my definition of alpha is the minimum angle of inclination for which you can have a steady flow in absence of sidewalls. So from the experiments of Pulikan in 1999, you can see that that minimum angle was equal to 21 degrees, something like that. So the tangent of 21 degrees is roughly 0.4. So we use alpha equal 0.4 here.
Is this flow depth measured by filming through the sidewalls?
So let me think. In the case of Job and co-workers, no. There was a blade inserted in the flow, as I remember. And there were some paint on it. And it was eroded by the flowing particles. So it was possible to determine the flow depth somewhere in the flow, as I remember, if I remember correctly. And for Felix and co-workers, I think it was from the sidewalls, but I'm not sure.
Yes.
So it was from the sidewalls. Yes. So there might be, you know, some variation in the spanwise direction.
But what were typical widths of the cell that Felix used? There's a variety of widths.
Yes. Felix used something from very narrow channels to very wide channels. Of course, they were narrower than for Job, than in case of Job. In the case of Job, it was something like 100 diameters, the width. In this case, it was from 10 to 60 or something like that. Yes?
As you are using the Trapezium rule, is the assumption on the concentration linearity important in this result?
No, I don't think so, because I use that approximation only in the momentum balances, so in order to have the distribution of the pressure. So I don't think that the linear distribution of the concentration is so important.
So I'm looking at the comparison between the data points, which are the experimental points, if I understand, and
yes,
the solid lines.
Yes.
And if I look only at the data points, then I don't see the discrete change in gradient.
Are you sure? Well, I don't know. I mean, of course.
Because if I look on the right domain,
yes,
and the solid line clearly cuts across the data, it comes from, if I approach it from the right, it comes from the top, and it goes through the data cloud towards the intersection point. And
so
if I look at the left domain, the worst happens. So if I would plot a function in the experimental data, it would not have that experience.
So it would be smoother.
Like it would be smooth.
So the idea is this one. Sorry for that, but here. Yeah. So when I say that this stress ratio is the value of the stress ratio at the top of the dense algebraic layer, so this is true, and this also tells you that for tangent of angle of inclination greater than this guy, you have a diffuse layer. If it's less or equal than this guy, you only have the dense algebraic layer. But that's not true, because if you only have the dense algebraic layer, so you have a free surface. So close to the free surface, still there is an influence of the energy diffusion. So in order to have the analytical solution, I'm just brutally distinguished between region where you have only the dense algebraic layer and regime where you have both. And this transition is rather sharp. Instead, there should be a more smooth transition from one.
The experimental data suggests that in reality, the transition between those regimes is not a discrete point.
Right. Well, it tells you that when disappear the diffuse layer and you enter in the dense layer, still you have a layer where the energy diffusion is important also in the dense layer. So we are neglecting completely the energy diffusion in the dense layer, which is not true when the diffusion
close
right.
Transition.
Just so I understand how you patch these layers together, what would the velocity profile look like?
Okay. Okay. I don't have a picture here, but I can. Okay, let me tell you. Okay. So in this case, we were using the trapezium rule, so we only have value for the velocity here and here. Okay.
Yeah.
And in this region instead, so given that there is the sidewalls, so you have a velocity which goes like the power of the distance from the bed to the 3/2, and there's an additional term which goes like the power of the distance from the bed to the 5/2, because there is the contribution of the sidewalls.
So this is like a Bagnold
profile. That's a Bagnold plus the idea of the sidewalls, which change the concavity. So you have something like that.
So there's a kink in the...
There's a change in the concavity.
Yeah, the velocity gradient isn't continuous.
Yes.
So how does that... Because the velocity gradient is tied to some of the other variables, right? It's determining the... temperature. So what's happening to the temperature? The temperature discontinues.
So let me see. Discontinuous here, you mean?
Yeah, because the velocity gradient is discontinuous.
Yeah, but for the analytical solution, we only need the velocity here and here. So when we perform the integration, we once again use the trapezium rule for the flow rate here. So let's say we have a velocity profile like that, and then we stop. And we don't know anything about what happens here, and we know only the velocity at the top. So we lack the information here.
But in principle, you could calculate that, because that's where kinetic theory should be good.
Yes, but we have to perform a numerical integration.
But can't you link them linearly?
We can't, and in that case, you have discontinuity in the derivative of the...
Point. But, yeah. but then I'm wondering what that means to the temperature, right?
Yes.
Because the temperature is tied to the...
Right.
And so is the temperature discontinuous?
Here, yes.
Yeah.
But of course, the fact is that on the other side of the face, we can't really say anything about the shear rate.
But presumably, you could just take the equations and solve. If you produced a numerical method for the top layer, you might be able to solve all the way down.
Right.
And then the whole lot should just drop out, and it would be a smooth transition between both of them.
Right. Yes. We could do that in principle, yes. But then we lack the analytical solution, which is nicer, you know.
Well, it was the scaling that was important, wasn't that?
Yeah, and the scaling was important, right? So it was nicer, an analytical solution. If it works, of course.
Right, yeah.
Well, about the scaling, we saw that the flow rate was still going like the power to the 2.5 of the distance between the sidewalls.
Yeah.
even in the experiments of Felix and co-workers in the rotating drum. And
wasn't the issue that Felix and his co-workers said the mu I rheology wasn't working in their experiments?
Yes, right. And they were true. They were.
Yes, it's true because
they were right, yes.
There's a diffuse layer. It's not all dense.
Right.
But the scaling is the same.
The scaling is the same, yes. Okay. So if there are no other questions, the idea was after that to see what was changing with an interstitial fluid in it. So so this is the picture of sediment transport that usually you got when you are in a class in hydraulics, for instance. So you got bed load, okay, and then you have suspended load, but I always had the feeling that there was something in between missing. So this is the typical picture of the bed load, okay, got from YouTube, very modern. So you have some particles moving above a bed which is immobile, okay, and this is the typical idea of a suspended load. So you have fine particles moving without actually interacting with each other, and transported by the turbulence of the fluid, essentially. Okay, but the idea was that, I mean, there should be something in between these two regimes, and this something is, for instance, this sheet flow that I think Luigi has already shown to you. This is an experiment with plastic cylinders. Okay, so there are not anymore just a few particles moving over a bed which is immobile. You have a layer of particles moving over an erodible bed, yes. But this is fundamentally different from the picture of the bed load that I was taught to in the hydraulics class. So, and if I look at this movie, so this movie, the motion of the particles very much resembles the motion of the particles in the rotating drum that I was showing to you before, okay? Apart from the presence of the fluid, of course. So the idea was maybe we can come out with something similar to what we have done. Okay. So once again, at the top, you have a collisionless layer. So the concentration is so low that you don't have collisions, okay? So in this case, the driving motion, the driving force, is not anymore the weight in the direction parallel to the flow. So I'm dealing here with horizontal flows, and the driving force is the shear stress exerted by the fluid at the top of the particles. So still, you have a collisionless layer at the top. Then once again, the concentration is increasing going towards the bed. The granular temperature is decreasing going towards the bed. So you have, once again, a diffuse collisional layer, in principle. And then a dense algebraic layer, as before. But there is an additional layer very close to the bed that I call the macro viscous layer. And I will explain later why there should be such a layer here. So thing is that here are the momentum and energy balance, okay, balances, sorry. So for the particles, once again, you have granular pressure equal to the weight. Okay, there's no angle in this case. Phi is equal to zero. For the shear stress of the particles, well, you have a balance which involves the fluid drag on the particles. Capital D is the drag. And something similar for the fluid momentum balance in the direction parallel to the flow. Okay, so still this is the drag. And then you have the energy balance, or the fluctuating energy balance for the particles. And if you have the fluid, there is an additional term here. It's a coupling term. And can be quite complicated. But the idea is, if the turbulence is suppressed, and this can be the case if the solid volume fraction is very high, because in that case, you know, the distance between the particles is very small. So the turbulence has no space to develop. And so if the concentration is very high, the turbulence is suppressed, maybe there, and there, the coupling term reduces to an additional dissipation due to the viscous drag. Okay? So, well, there is an alternative to this approach, which is more complicated. And the alternative is to keep the energy balance as in the dry case, but to incorporate this additional dissipation due to the viscosity of the fluid in the coefficient of restitution. So using a coefficient of restitution which depends on the Stokes number. So if the Stokes number is very large, like in the dry case, then this guy is equal to zero, so you got the coefficient of restitution as in the dry case, and I call that epsilon. If the Stokes number is very low, because the fluid viscous forces are important, then the effective coefficient of restitution is reduced. Okay? And the Stokes number is the measure of the particle inertia with respect to the fluid viscous forces. And we use as a measure of the approaching velocity during a collision the square root of the granular temperature, which is the natural measure in the kinetic theory approach. Okay, so the square root of the granular temperature gives you the collisional velocity. Okay, the velocity just before the collision. So this is the definition of the Stokes number, okay? And that means also that if we go back to the picture, the granular temperature goes down here. That means that the Stokes number goes down in this direction. So that means that the coefficient of restitution moves from the dry value to, at a certain point, maybe zero. So when the Stokes number is so low, that the coefficient of restitution, the effective coefficient of restitution is zero, then below that, there is a layer where the collisions are no longer. So you cannot use any more kinetic theory to maybe to solve for the flow field there. So this is a layer which is dominated by the fluid viscous forces, and that's why I call it a macro viscous layer. Okay? So that's why you have to have a macro viscous layer close to the bed, because the granular temperature goes down and the Stokes number goes down. Okay? So there is this additional layer with respect to the dry case. Okay? So I'm not entering too much in details, but these are the key assumptions in this case. So this is just like before. It's an horizontal flow, so I'm using the boundary layer approximation for the total shear stress. Okay, constant, the total shear stress. Once again, concentration linearly distributed, same way as before. Also for the velocity. So the idea is, in the dense layers, the concentration is so high that the turbulence is suppressed. So you can neglect the shear stress in the fluid there with respect to that in the particle. Once again, negligible diffusion in the dense layers. And once again, the yielding at the bed. Okay? So
you're also neglecting turbulent suspension.
Oh, sorry, yes. I didn't say that, but yeah. I'm also neglecting the possibility of turbulent suspension in the flow. Okay? We will see later how we can deal with that.
And P is pressure in which phase?
P in the particle, capital P in the fluid. It's always like that. S in the particle, capital S in the fluid.
So why does the temperature decrease? Because, I mean, you need to, at the bottom of the layer, you need to generate lots of particle normal support, right?
Sorry? Oh, because the pressure is increasing, going down.
Yeah.
But the pressure has two contributions. One is due to the temperature, and the other one is due to the function of the concentration. So if the concentration increases much, and this happens when you approach the singularity and the kinetic function, then the granular temperature goes down. Okay? So this is just a picture of the assumption that I've shown to you before. So the additional idea is that E is equal to zero here at the top of this layer, this macro viscous layer. So we can solve everything like before, okay? I'm not showing you how to do that. It's a bit more complicated because of this dependence of the coefficient of restitution on the Stokes number. So it's a bit, it's more tricky solution, but you can do that analytically. I'm sorry for that, Nico. And well, the shear stress exerted by the fluid at the top of the particles in dimensionless term is just the Shields number. Okay, so the idea is fixing the Shields number, you can obtain analytical solution for the depths and the particle velocity, and that means also analytical solution for the particle flow rate. And this is, let's say, what you can get. So capital phi is the particle flow rate in dimensionless term, okay, per unit width, and theta is the Shields number. Okay, I put it in this way only because it's the usual way in which hydraulic people are accustomed to see this kind of transport equation. Okay, and in the usual, most famous equation like Mayer-Petter-Muller, this coefficient psi is a constant, like equal to 8 in this case. For Wong and Parker, it was roughly 4. There's another theory developed by Capart and Luigi Fratarollo. They said it was roughly 4 once again. Well, actually, from this analytical solution, what you got is that this coefficient is a function of the Shields number. It's not a constant. Okay. And for sand and gravel in water, for instance, this is the behavior of this coefficient psi, okay, as a function of the Shields number. For different particle Reynolds number, I have translated the particle Reynolds number in particle diameter. Okay. So different curves depending on the size of the particles. But as you can see, the range of variation is very high. Of course, in the experiments of Mayer-Petter-Muller, the Shields number was very small, so something like very close to here. And as you can see, very close to here, psi is equal to roughly 4, okay? So it's not so bad. But of course, if you go to larger values of the Shields number, then things change, okay? Okay, so after that, we got this equation. We can make comparisons with experiments. Okay. The circles here are experiments performed by Wilson and reported in Nadine Wilson in 1992. 0.7 millimeter of sand in water. And Shields number in this case, let's say from 0.6 or something to 2 in this case. Okay. So the black solid line is the analytical solution that we got. And these other three guys are the formulas that I was, the usual formula for sediment transport that I mentioned to you before. So as you can see, the usual formula, like the Mayer-Petter-Muller, which is widely used also in commercial software, largely underestimated the sediment transport, is the particle flow rate, okay, per unit width. And instead, our analytical solution seems to do fine. Okay, up to a certain point, maybe. It seems to be all right.
What was the nature of the flow on that guy in Wilson?
It was a horizontal flow in a pipe in a closed conduit, rectangular section.
Driven by pressure.
Driven by pressure, yes. Okay, so looks fine, but then I'm cheating because if I... Well, before to admit that I'm cheating, I have to tell you something. I can find the limits of the theory because the theory must apply when there is at least one diameter layer of particles involved. Okay, so this sets the minimum value of the Shields number for this theory to hold. And this minimum Shields number is around 0.2 for sand. That means 4 times the critical Shields number. Okay, so we are kind of far away from the bed load, from the ordinary bed load. But we can also see which is the maximum Shields number for which the theory applies, because we are neglecting the turbulent suspension. And well, the turbulent suspension becomes important when the ratio of the fluid shear velocity and the particle setting velocity is equal to 1, roughly. Okay. So that means that if we know the particle settling velocity, we can find the maximum value of the Shields number for which the theory can apply. And this maximum is around 1.3 for the sand for the 0.7 millimeter sand in water. So if we go back, 1.3 roughly here, okay. Well, you can see these points are below the curve, okay. This is an indication maybe. If I use all the points though, this is what I got. So once again, well, up to 1.3, I'm doing fine. But then the points are just something else with respect to the field.
Why are you over-predicting rather than under-predicting?
I will try to explain that in a few moments. Okay, so I was here and I decided, well, the next step was to include the turbulent suspension in the equation. Okay, so the way to do that, the way that I did is to use the theory of McTeague, who saw that the turbulent suspension is essentially turbulent lift due to the fact that when you perform the average, the FAB averaging, okay, there is a correlation between the drag force, the fluctuations in the drag force, and the fluctuations in the concentration. And this additional term is present in the momentum balances in the direction perpendicular to the flow. So that means, so this is like a particle lift, turbulent lift, okay? And this is due to this correlation. And you can model this term using a simple diffusion model, okay? And saying that this guy is proportional to the gradient in the volume fraction. And the coefficient of proportionality is something like the turbulent viscosity, something like that. Okay, so this is the idea. So in order to express this term in a very simple way, so I use the idea that the drag coefficient when there are many particles settling in a fluid is somehow inversely proportional to the particle settling velocity through the concentration. Okay, so I substitute this capital C with this expression. And then I introduce the model for diffusion, as suggested by McTeague. Okay, so gradient of the volume fraction is here. And this is something like the turbulent viscosity. K is the von Karman constant, if you like. U star is the shear velocity. And you can calculate this as the square root of the Schiltz number divided by fluid density. Okay. And as a length scale, I'm using just the depth of the diffuse layer, because it's in the diffuse layer that the turbulence can develop, not in the dense layer below. Okay? So this is the length scale that I'm using for the turbulence. It's a very, very crude model for the turbulence. But the hope was that it was enough to capture, at least at first order, the flow rate. Okay? So if you substitute this model in here, so you got this, okay, and then you can say, well, this is the many particle setting velocity. If I want to use the single particle setting velocity, because it's easier to measure, okay, well, I can do that by using maybe a coefficient of proportionality. So I introduce a coefficient, C, which is something of order unity, okay, and so I come out with this correction factor for the distribution of the pressure. And this tells you that if you have turbulent suspension, the particle pressure, which is a collisional pressure, is reduced because part of the weight of the particles is supported by the turbulent lift instead of by the collisions. Okay? So this is a correction factor that you have only if you have turbulent suspension. Okay, so I could have done something starting from that, but I decided to use an even cruder approach. And the cruder approach was, okay, so that means that the weight of the particles, if you have turbulent suspension, is partially supported by the turbulent lift. So that means that the collisional pressure decreases. That means that you have less collisions. So that also means that only a portion of the fluid shear stress that is exerted at the top of the particles induce particle motion. because part of it induces just turbulent lift. It's spent somehow to suspend the particles instead of driving the particles into motion. So maybe a simple approach is, well, everything I've done is correct. The only idea is, well, the flow rate, the particle flow rate that I have calculated must not be associated with the Schiltz number, with the actual Schiltz number, but with a larger Schiltz number. Because you need a larger Schiltz number to have the same flow rate, because part of that Schiltz number is spent to suspend the particles instead of moving the particles. Okay? So what I've done is just to introduce this ratio of an effective Schiltz number with respect to the actual Schiltz number, and using the same correction factor that I got from the pressure. Okay? And here, well, there is the inverse of the Ruse number for who of you that are accustomed to. Okay? So in this theory, there is only this coefficient, C, that has to be set. And, well, as a first approximation, I use one, just one. And this is what I got. So this curve has to move in this direction. And now you can recover all the experiments pretty well.
So you put turbulent suspension in them.
Yes.
So
from here,
less particle transport, or
so that means that the same particle flow rate, this point, must be associated with a larger Schiltz number, because this difference is spent to suspend the particles instead of to drive the particles into motion.
So for a fixed Schiltz number,
okay,
you reduce the particle transport.
Yes.
Does that seem right somehow? I mean,
well, the explanation is what I told you before. The explanation that I had in mind.
So the introduction of turbulence is essentially reducing the, which is supposed to be suspending it.
Right, because part of the shear stress is not used to drive the particles. Mm-hmm. It's used to suspend the particles.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the shear stress at each level divided between the fluid and the particles has to be constant instead of steady.
The total shear stress.
Yeah, the total shear stress of each level.
Yeah.
So I don't understand how that can.
That means that in the dense layer, the turbulence is not entirely suppressed, but there is a part of the fluid turbulence which still matters. Okay. Yes.
So related to Jim's question, the shear rate you use in the Schiltz number, you use the value at the top, right? But the value can be very different at different locations.
Yes. So, once again, the idea of this coefficient is to take into account all these approximations, just to have an average behavior.
And you adjusted that value of the coefficient?
Yeah, I mean, as a first trial, I just took one, and it was working. But the fact is that it was working not only for 0.7 millimeter sand in water, but also for plastic particles in water. I don't show that here, but I was performing comparison also with the plastic particles and other kind of particles, and it was working as well. Same value of C.
Now, how is the shield number is measured experimentally?
Okay, so we have to ask to the experimentalist, because I just took the value in the paper. Let me see. Probably from the law of the wall of the velocity or the fluid velocity above the particles. So it was a kind of logarithmic profile, and they were inferring the shear stress there from the logarithmic profile. If I remember correct, I may be wrong.
Because, and in your model, it's calculated in the
at the top of the diffuse layer.
Okay, where there is no particle.
Well, there is no particle, but this is it's a boundary layer approximation, so the total shear stress is constant in the particle layer.
Yeah.
These experiments were done with a pressure gradient.
Yes. Yeah, everything is.
Take the shear stress from the pressure gradient.
Yeah, but if you use the boundary layer approximation, then you can neglect the effect of the pressure gradient. If the
I mean, it tells you what the shear stress is at the
time. Oh, sorry, yeah. Yeah, right, yeah, right. But you have to correct for the shape of the conduit. Yeah. Okay, that was right. Probably they used the two approach in order to check the correction for the shape of the cross section.
Correction formula. So if the shield number becomes so Rouse number is a bit like shield number, isn't it?
Sorry?
The Rouse number is a bit like the shield number. It's
yeah, there is the shield number here, yes.
So if that becomes very large,
yes,
then that's gonna become negative.
Let's talk about that now. Oh yes. Okay. Sorry, I'm keeping. No, that's okay. I'll talk to okay.
Are you going to move away from this talk?
No.
Okay. I'm trying to follow your logic beyond your approach, and I could also say I take Meyer-Peter-Müller, but yep. That's only for bed load, and it's under predicting. But I know that there is also suspension, so I put a correction factor on it, which increases transport because there is suspension. And then I'm kind of reasoning in a way which is very similar to what I would think about what the trend was. As Nico says, you're adding turbulence, but you're decreasing the transport. But I feel you can also argue from the bed load condition and say, I add turbulence and I add suspension, and thereby increase my...
But in that case, the problem is that from bed load, the bed load of Meyer-Peter-Müller, if you increase the shear number, you move to a regime where you have collision. Okay? And that was the first part of this second part of the talk. And then if you had turbulent suspension, then you have to correct the flow rate that you got from the collision on sediment transport because you have turbulent suspension. So it's more straightforward. You move from bed load, where you have just some particles moving, to many particles moving over a bed but suspended by collisions. To many particles moving over a bed, suspended by collision and by turbulent suspension, and this is the correction, to something else that is linked to the previous question. So it's more, I don't know, it's more physical, and so in my perspective is more related to the physics. That's my impression.
The shear parameter is the ratio of the turbulent shear stress to roughly the weight of a layer of particles. And what you're saying is that the presence of suspension effectively reduces the weight
yes.
of a layer of particles right. and effectively increases the shear parameter.
That's right. Yes, that's another way to put it. Yeah. Once again, now I have to find the limits of this corrected theory. And the limits are, well, the minimum shear number is still the same as before. But the maximum shear number now is the shear number for which the entire weight of the particles is supported by the turbulent suspension. And that means that for values of shear number greater than this, you have the fully suspended load mode. And this is equal to around 7 for the 7.7 millimeter sand in water. So now this theory should apply from 0.2 to 7. Which is not bad. Okay. Of course, these values depend on the size of the particle. So if you have different sizes, this range is different. Okay. So for very fine particles, this maximum value is for Schiff's number very low. So in practical, you always see suspended load. Okay.
Depends on the size of the particle through the particle Reynolds number and the drag?
The particle Reynolds number, actually, yes.
So how would you adjust your sediment transport equation there? You showed on the previous slide, more or less, four different particle sizes. Yeah, that. Not the one that...
This one? Oh, this one?
No. That one.
Okay.
How would you adjust that then for different particle sizes?
So if the particle Reynolds number decreases, the flow rate is larger. Yeah. If the particles Reynolds number increases, it's...
Okay.
Okay. Okay, here. Okay, so just for fun, I perform some calculations. So in a water stream of depth of more than 1 meter, okay, at a certain slope, which is either a torrent, so slope of order 1%, or a plane, so slope of order 1/1000, okay. So for silt, so if you have a size of order 10^-4 meters, well, either in torrent or in the plane, you are in a fully suspended mode, okay. So if you have sand, millimeters in size, well, in a plane, you have one. In a torrent, in mountains, you have something like 10. So it's probably always a collisional flow with or without turbulent suspension, but it's a collisional sediment transport. So if you have gravel, centimeters, then you have, in a plane, ordinary bed load. In a torrent, it becomes collisional, okay? If you have boulders of all the this, yeah, 10^-1 meter, yeah, you always have ordinary bed load, either in plain or in mountains. So that helps me in finding the where I could apply this this kind of theory. So the next step that we took, just the last two slides, was to include the effect of inclination. And I think that Luigi has already told you something about it. Okay, so just the same, but with inclination. So not driven by a pressure gradient, horizontal flow, but an inclined flow. So you will have a free surface also for the fluid. Okay, not entering details at all, promise, and just show you the results. The results is the limits of the theory that I was telling to you above before. So minimum value of the Schiltz number for the transition from the ordinary bed load to the collisional sediment transport, the transition from the collisional sediment transport to the collisional sediment transport with turbulent suspension, and I could have added another curve here for the transition to a fully turbulent mode, okay, now are a function of the angle of inclination. So Schiltz number, angle of inclination. So as you can see, this kind of regime map can be built for different particles. And you can put the experimental points in it and see what is the regime there and see if the theory that I've shown to you before applies or not. So in this case, these were the experiments of Capat and Luigi. Plastic cylinders and water. This is the specific density, 1.5, okay, light particles. And as you can see, the experimental points were all in the collisional sediment transport regime map. Okay, if you increase too much the angle of inclination, you move to a debris flow, where the position of the top of the particles and the top of the fluid are roughly the same. Okay. So below you have sediment transport and you have these three regimes, maybe four if you add the fully suspended. Okay. So in this case it was collisional sediment transport, and the analytical solution, well, followed quite well the experiments as well in terms of flow rate versus Schiltz number. And
was there a correction here for suspension?
No, because we are collisional sediment transport. And here for the experiments by SMART on very polydispersed mixture of gravel, sand and gravel in water, okay? Specific density 2.6. So the experiments were, once again, almost all in the collisional sediment transport, but for one, probably, okay? And once again, you know, the analytical solution is following pretty well the experiment. And I think this is it. Let me see. No, this is just a perspective for future. So the perspective, of course, are to move through the boundaries, so towards the ordinary bed load and towards the fully suspended load. So this is the idea. Maybe adding polydispersity, we will see. And dealing with the oscillating flows, which has some importance in the coastal engineering, I think. I don't know. We'll see. Thank you.
Waves are important.
Always, yes. Thank you.
You're, I think it seems to me buried in all of your models here is that value of E, the coefficient of restitution, is that correct? Now, is that, you just pick a value based on glass spheres? Is that how
okay.
that works?
No.
How do you correct that for actual quartz particles that may not be so spherical or so smooth?
Okay, so for glass spheres, we use 0.6 because it was the result of the theory using the 3 microparameters which characterizes collision for glass spheres. For plastic particles, for plastic spheres, we have the 3 micro properties for plastic spheres as well. So it was possible to derive the effective coefficient restitution. And it's something like 0.6 as well. So here we were using plastic cylinders. But for plastic cylinders with a ratio of diameter to length, to width, which is close to 1. So not so far from being spheres. Okay. So once again, I use 0.6. And for sand and gravel, that was an issue, actually, because nobody measured that. But I was able to find there was a paper dealing with the impact of sand particles over an erodible bed made of sand. And they were measuring the coefficient of restitution of the rebounding particles. And I took just the average over all the angle of impact. And it was something like 0.45. And that was I used. So that's what I used, sorry.
That's for the dry part of the coefficient of restitution.
Right. That's right. So that was the only idea that I had in mind at the time.
Questions?
Yes.
Yeah. It seems a very counterintuitive statement. The suspension fixed applied pressure or shear stress.
Yeah, yeah. I crashed my mind over it for a while because to try to figure it out.
But you're really sure that your argument is consistent for that?
Seems to be, but I hope.
There's a lot about the things that, you know, if you add an extra term, you could get a good agreement, but it doesn't mean that the argument is right.
Right.
But what about numerical solutions? You could calculate those with a complete theory without the chain of approximation.
I wanted to do that. I didn't do that yet, but I wanted. Yes. Yeah, that's a way to check it. Yes.
All right. Okay. Thanks again.